This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
If I wear a Stacey Abrams shirt in the airport, black men, black women will be like, where'd you get that thing from to this date? And I'll buy it off of you right now.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, and this is Marcus Farrell, a political organizer in Atlanta.
We're not going to increase the turnout of black women by 20 points because black women already vote at the highest rate. Obama won because black men, Latino brothers, finally voted at high rates.
Farrell has worked with the New Georgia Project, which is leading voter registration drives in the state, and he says that the most untapped voting bloc is black men.
When I go and talk to black men, they are not impressed with the current talking points that candidates are providing them. The things that candidates are very comfortable talking about aren't the things that black men care about at all. Right. So we want health care. That might be great. But there's no one having conversations about keeping black men out of jail. There's no one having conversations about increasing trade work so African-American men can get jobs and be healthy, beneficial parts of society. So it's a different thing to say, I believe in Medicare for all. But if you can go to a black man and say, I believe in Medicare for all, and this is why it's going to help you, black man, then that's a different conversation. But no one wants to have that conversation. Everybody wants to talk in Iowa speak. Iowa speak is generalized conversations to 41-year-old white women to make them like you and make them feel safe that you're going to be a good pick for president. Even the media and even the press and even the pollsters go to people who are already going to vote. But you don't win with likely voters. You win with turnout voters. And turnout people just want to hear, what are you going to do for me? How are you going to help my life? How are you going to help me feed my babies? How are you going to help me work one job and be able to pay all of my bills? How are you going to create a living wage? How are you going to stop gentrification in my neighborhood? Because I'm getting taxed out of my grandmama's house right now, right? That's what voters who are unlikely. And the unlikely voters are the reason that we were going to win. So some of the most impressive things have been Tom Steyer running ads or in South Carolina speaking about reparations. That's one of the reasons why Tom Steyer went up in the polls, because there are candidates that talk to black men. I just don't think that the candidates that talk to black men have a chance.
Marcus Farrell, a political organizer in Atlanta. As Farrell pointed out, the last time a Democrat won the White House, he had enormous support from black voters. And this year, with Kamala Harris and Cory Booker out of the race, the four white frontrunners may really struggle to get the turnout they need. I called up Jelani Cobb to talk about the black vote in the 2020 election. Jelani is a staff writer and a historian, and I reached him in his office at Columbia University. In the State of the Union address, it seemed to me that among the many dramas and themes, race played a central role. On the one hand, you had Donald Trump
gesturing toward any number of people of color in the audience, including a Tuskegee Airman. At the same time, he awarded the Medal of Freedom, the highest award a civilian can get, to Rush Limbaugh, whose record of racist statements is extremely long. What was the motivation in racial terms and in electoral terms of this strategy that clearly was animating the State of the Union address?
Yeah, I think that it was a really interesting spectacle. There was a kind of tokenization of African Americans. Who could be against recognizing a Tuskegee Airman, particularly a man who is, you know, over 100 years old and still looks like, you know, he could report for duty, you know, tomorrow morning if need be. And so there's a kind of gross, ham-fisted showcasing of black people. It's a more refined version, I think, than what we've seen before, because if you remember the Trump of the 2016 campaign era, when he was literally saying, "Look at my African American."
Right, there. I have Don King.
Yes, exactly. You know, I have Don King and Kanye. What else do I need? It was a deeply cynical moment, and you know, maybe we should be accustomed to that. Maybe, you know, cynicism is the native language that Trump speaks in. But I think that what struck me about the State of the Union was that he seems to be speaking it more fluently.
Well, exactly, and it seems to me that it's all about the campaign. He knows he's not going to win the black vote, so-called black vote. He's not going to win the Hispanic vote. But if he can raise the percentages just a bit in a very, very close election, that might be decisive.
I think that's absolutely right. And if you think about the statement he made in 2016, where he said, you know, what do you have to lose? Well, you know, people who are looking at public policy would say a great deal. You know, Trump was a beneficiary in 2016 of a perception among, you know, a fairly sizable part of the African-American electorate that there wasn't that much difference between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. And I think that what we're seeing is laying the groundwork for raising those same sort of cynical perspectives about whoever will wind up being the nominee, you know, later on this year on the Democratic side. And depending upon who he's talking about, that could be an effective strategy, you know, especially given the way we've seen race and history and civil rights and people's personal backgrounds on these issues become a subject in the Democratic debates and now in the Democratic primaries.
We just heard from Marcus Farrell, who's been doing work to engage with black voters, and he paints a picture of a huge disconnect between the issues that Democrats are talking about and the issues that are important to the black community. Do you see a disconnect there?
Sure. And so I think what's happened has been, you know, a kind of big tent idea with the Democratic Party, and the concern that the tent has gotten so big that the roof is now sagging. And what I mean by that is, do you want to go all in on the issues that are most concerning to African Americans and potentially turn off the elusive, ever sought after working class white voter? And so I think that there is a disconnect. But what's interesting is Bernie Sanders, in that he has gone with a very kind of old school, almost old left form of economic populism, and had a surprising degree of effectiveness in luring African American voters. He's light years behind Joe Biden. Joe Biden has about 48% of African Americans supporting him, and Bernie Sanders only has about 20%. But that's still impressive, you know, given that he's really one of the people who kind of prioritizes the interests of the working class and people who've been left behind and so on, and is now more accustomed to making appeals specifically to the issues that affect African Americans. But that's far from a language, I think, that he speaks naturally.
Sanders's 2016 campaign was often criticized for its failure to reach out to black voters. Did you agree with that criticism, and has he fixed it in 2020? He seems to be getting quite a few African-American voters who are younger, while Biden seems to be drawing from an older population.
Bernie Sanders has one of the more interesting developments in political evolutions. in 2016, his really poor showing among African Americans, especially African Americans in the South, was attributed to all sorts of things. There was even a question about whether there was an aspect of anti-Semitism in people's disregard for him or their disinterest in him. You don't hear any of that now. It's fairly remarkable that he has 20%. In South Carolina, his numbers are about that as well, you know, somewhere in the 20% range. He benefits from having some fairly high-profile African-Americans who were supportive of him. You know, if we kind of think back to Cornel West and his constant critiques of Barack Obama, he's right there, you know, next to Bernie Sanders, you know, for the whole way of his campaign. And also, in 2016, his events were disrupted twice by Black Lives Matter protesters. This year, he has significant numbers of people who are young grassroots activists who are like right there campaigning for him.
Now, is Joe Biden's appeal to the African American community so far 95% of its stardust from his relationship to Barack Obama?
Yeah, I think it's probably 60% stardust from Barack Obama and 40% the idea that he is the type of person that other voters, namely white voters, might be inclined to vote for over Donald Trump. And so it's the kind of electability argument over once again. And I think that it's interesting to see how this is playing as well, because it is very much contingent upon results. If we thought about Barack Obama, he surged in popularity in South Carolina and surged in popularity among African Americans in South Carolina after he won Iowa, because he had essentially proved to black voters that white voters were willing to vote for him, so he wouldn't be a wasted vote. I think that in a way, Joe Biden faces the opposite problem, that his African-American support may begin to erode if there are significant suspicions that maybe he isn't as popular with the kind of Joe Lunchbucket white guy as black voters would perceive him to be.
Now, Pete Buttigieg came out of the Iowa caucuses in a pretty strong position, but he's got very little support among black voters so far, particularly in South Carolina. Why is that?
I saw Pete Buttigieg speak at Morehouse College in Atlanta. And, you know, Morehouse College, very well-known, historically black college for men. And he laid out his case and got kind of like golf applause at the end of it. And it was interesting. I said, you know, I was watching. I said, I think that there's a cultural difference here, which is he's a Midwestern guy, and he was talking at a Southern college. I was like, I don't think he would have fared well with Southern white people, because he was very reserved in that sense. And people expect you to have a little bit more of your personality, a little bit more of who you are on the surface. But that's just the kind of superficial part of it. Much more substantively, I think, is the concerns of African Americans in South Bend. I have a rule about politics, which is to never trust someone who's more popular away from home than they are at home. African Americans in South Bend are very critical of him, particularly around issues of policing. If he winds up being the nominee, you can expect the Republican Party to make a lot of references to South Bend. You can expect there to be commercials from PACs featuring disgruntled black people who were in the city when he was mayor. And I think that would be an all-out assault while they're going full tilt talking about what they've done for criminal justice reform on the Republican side.
Now, Jelani, we started out the primary race with several pretty high-profile candidates of color: Kamala Harris, Cory Booker, Julian Castro, and they're all gone. And you've got Deval Patrick, who's in the race, but not so as you'd notice. He's polling at below 1%. Why hasn't he caught on? And how has the race been changed by the fact that these other candidates of color have dropped out?
Yeah, I think that there's a problem with that, a visibility problem. And, you know, it doesn't help that you have a billionaire on the stage who essentially bought his way onto the stage, and another billionaire who appears to be on the verge of buying his way onto the stage as well.
So we're talking Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg.
Tom Steyer and Mike Bloomberg. And I think there is the line, there were more billionaires than black people on the stage, you know, during the debates. And so where I think this will become really tricky is if the DNC rules allow Mike Bloomberg to get onto the next debate. And people were saying we essentially changed the rules to allow him to get his foot in the door, while the firm thresholds did not allow Cory Booker to continue making his case for why he should be elected president. I think that ultimately, whoever gets the nomination, we are likely to see a person of color in the vice presidential slot. If it's Elizabeth Warren, it seems fairly reasonable to expect Julian Castro. But there are all sorts of people who are coming up. You know, Kamala Harris comes up, Cory Booker comes up, Stacey Abrams still comes up as a person that people would expect to see getting tapped to be in the vice presidential slot, depending upon who wins the nomination.
Now, if Iowa told me anything, it told me that this is the dissatisfaction about the catastrophic disorganization in Iowa is just a precursor to what is, if not likely, then very deeply possible in November, which is that the election will not be considered legitimate.
Right.
If Trump wins, the scale of suspicion and disappointment will be almost unspeakable, and Trump is almost certain to challenge any election unless he's crushed in that election. I don't see that happening.
Yeah, I think I've had this conversation with a few people of late. And, you know, one of the things that the impeachment did was send me and lots of other people, I imagine, back to the Federalist Papers. And one of the things that comes across in reading them is the real fear that, you know, certainly Hamilton and Madison had about the possibility of political violence coming as a result of, you know, the system operating on bad faith in some way, shape, or form. And, you know, when, you know, notably Adam Schiff read from that letter from Hamilton to Washington and described the kind of character he was afraid of, and it sounded very similar to the character that we have come to know Donald Trump to be. So would a person with his history and his particular psychology, can that person stand being humiliated on the biggest stage in the world by losing an election? Not likely. And is he above saying that the election is illegitimate? I don't think so.
He was ready to say it last time. I mean, he was talking about it's being stolen and rigged and all the rest until he won, until that terrifying moment for him when he stood up and had to declare victory.
So what happens if he does that now with all the kind of institutional power that he now wields? I think the possibility of political violence in the country has increased significantly, and certainly heading into the election is something that we can't dismiss as a real possibility.
Jelani, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jelani Cobb is a professor at the Columbia Journalism School, and he's a staff writer at The New Yorker. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds, Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Tyler Foggett has a wide range of interests. Recently, she wrote about Jay Sekulow, one of the Trump lawyers in the impeachment trial, who also happens to play drums in a classic rock band, if you like that sort of thing. And Tyler knows all kinds of weird stuff, and she's always got interesting things to recommend. Tyler, welcome. Please surprise me.
So I recently saw this movie called Cure. It came out in 1997. It's this Japanese horror film directed by Kiyoshi Kurosawa. And the reason why I went to go see it is because I saw Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, and I really liked it. And I read an article where Bong was talking about how Cure was his all-time favorite film.
So it's by the other Kurosawa, right?
I mean, yes.
Akira Kurosawa is the classic filmmaker from Japan who we all know. This is the other guy.
Exactly, yeah. This one is about, I think he was born like 50 years later.
Yeah.
But yeah, so the movie is basically about a string of like, seemingly unconnected murders taking place in Tokyo. It sort of starts off as like a police procedural whodunit type film, but they tell you who did it pretty early on. In this particular scene, the detective and suspect are having a conversation where, in which the suspect says that he sort of feels a kinship with the detective. And you can kind of see reality break down, and it's actually unclear whether the conversation is even happening or whether it's in the detective's head.
Okay, the conversation just went from conversation to he threw him against the wall.
Yes. Yeah, there are a lot of mood shifts in this movie, which is also how I see it as being kind of similar to Parasite.
Let's move on. Let's go to the second thing that you're up to. What have you been listening to, maybe?
Yeah, so it's a remix of Kanye West's song Say You Will, which was originally on his 2008 album 808s and Heartbreak. And in 2015, he came out with this remix of the song that's just like completely different, where he collaborated with Caroline Shaw. She's this Pulitzer Prize winning musician, the youngest musician ever to win a Pulitzer Prize. And she's really interesting because she has this choral technique where it's sort of like her voice singing layered on top of it, like over and over and over again. So it's like a one person choir almost.
Why would she make calls out the blue?
Yeah, I remember this one. I do.
Now I'm awake, sleeping soon. Hey, 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 don't say you will.
I absolutely love this song. I listen to it almost every day.
Don't say you will.
I mean, now he's sort of known for his whole Sunday service thing, which is him reimagining all of his old songs as gospel tunes. And a lot of people don't really like it, either because they don't like gospel music or because they think it's sort of indicative of a lack of creativity. I mean, why go back and redo something you've already done when you can make something new? But I actually think it's really interesting that he is willing to return to these old songs over and over and over again and completely reinvent them. It's almost like each song is a platonic ideal, and then each new version that he makes of the song is like a reflection of that ideal.
Hey, 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 hey.
I've become sort of obsessed with this Netflix show called The Chilling Adventures of Sabrina. The third season just dropped pretty recently, and I watched it all in like 2 days.
You watched that and not Messiah.
Exactly. And the show is basically a reboot of Sabrina the Teenage Witch, which was on like in the 90s and early 2000s. And I grew up in like a pretty, you know, traditional household. And I'll tell you, I was given the hardest time for watching that show because
That was considered satanic in some way?
Yeah, because it's like a promotion of witchcraft. I mean, it's like for the same reasons.
So for religious reasons.
Yeah,
it
exactly.
Came down on you.
It's like, you know, I was given a hard time for reading like Harry Potter and that kind of thing too. And so I'm going to play you a clip from the original Sabrina because you'll see that it's just the lightest show in the entire world.
Why don't you guys go and I'll stay home with Salem?
Hey, the whole point of a family vacation is so I can get a vacation from the family. Please, I need some downtime.
How old were you when you were watching this?
I was like in middle school. Yeah, I was pretty young.
And you were sort of, you know, right in front of the TV, fists on chin.
Exactly.
Absorbed.
I thought that Salem was like literally the coolest cat in the world. I was just obsessed with this show. And so when I heard that this reboot was happening, I was interested. I just thought that I would check it out, especially because it's made by the same guy who produces Riverdale, which is another show that I quite like.
Sabrina.
Who are you?
So you have Sabrina, played by Kiernan Shipka, little Sally Draper from Mad Men.
I heard you calling in the woods. And I came.
Ah, there's the cat.
Yes, now he's a cat. But it's a crazy show. It's about this group of witches who worship the devil. And the big twist is that Sabrina is not half mortal, half witch, as you've been led to believe, but actually half mortal, half demon. She is Lucifer's daughter.
Amazing.
Yeah, it's quite a career turn.
Amazing. Well, these are, I would say this is our darkest pick three in a while.
Yeah. Happy Valentine's Day.
Yeah. Thanks. Tyler Foggett, thanks so much.
You can find all of Tyler Foggett's writing on politics and a thousand other subjects at NewYorker.com. The comedian Louis C.K. is on his first tour since a sexual misconduct scandal early in the Me Too movement. Now, the details are hardly pleasant to hear about, so heads up, especially if you're listening with kids. The gist of it is that in 2017, after some years of rumors, a number of female comedians came forward and charged that Louis had exposed himself and masturbated in front of them. Louis didn't deny this for the most part, but claims that he believed that these women were consenting. The New Yorker's Hilton Alls went to see Louis C.K.'s show just as the tour began. Not long ago, you exchanged the high seat of drama critic of the New Yorker for a more generalized criticism. You wanted to get out and see more different things.
Yes.
Great. And so instead of being at the Vivian Beaumont Theater or the Winter Garden, you found yourself at the Yuck Yuck Club, a small comedy club on the Canadian side of Niagara Falls.
Have you ever been?
Not yet.
Yeah.
Watching Louis C.K. trying to gin up a comeback tour. Why was this an event worth getting on an airplane for? Why is it important?
Because Louis C.K. is a really significant artist. And I don't mean just in terms of stand-up or situation comedy. He was a fantastic writer. And also, I think, an incredible politician about race.
I get the distinct feeling that you're just trying to acquire a black friend. Yes, that's exactly what I'm doing. But I'm not doing it for me. I'm doing it for my daughter.
I think his show, where he was co-parenting with his black ex-wife, was one of the more...
This is the FX show. Luke.
Yes. Yeah. Was one of the more astounding things I had ever seen in this culture about... race being what you made of it. The thing that was so profound for me as a viewer was that his wife was black and he never mentioned it. It was one of those things that every week there would be 2 to 3 people of color who would call me and say, did you see that thing? Like, he never said it. So
right, it's not even a plot point.
It's not anything, you know, and we were able to see him and to see her as humans. Interacting with each other. It was one of the more liberating things I've ever seen.
But even so, he's got a big career, and then all of a sudden, 2017, five women accused CK of sexual misconduct, which in some cases involved masturbating in front of them.
Yes.
And that led to FX, they ended their relationship with him, his film I Love You Daddy was shelved, animated series that TBS was going to do canceled, HBO canceled some comedy specials, as did Netflix, his longtime manager dumped him, the Disney Channel redubbed his voice in reruns of the animated shows, Gravity Falls. In other words, end of career, it seemed.
Right.
And then you find yourself at in Niagara Falls at the Yuck Yuck Club.
Yes.
And you get into this room, and he takes the microphone, and it's a typical comedy club. And how did he do?
Not so good. There were brilliant things about, you know, going to an antique shop and how much he hates the sound of the bell over the antique shop, and also having dinner by himself in a Chinese restaurant, and then talking about, it was actually very moving, imitating the woman who was talking to him, who owned the Chinese restaurant, who was Chinese, and he said, I'm quoting her, I'm not making fun of her accent. And then there was a lovely, incredibly smart moment, I would say about a minute, where he talked about imitating other people. So there were flashes of it, but nothing really sort of added up to a script. Mm-hmm. There was no spine to it at all. He was sort of throwing out information and bits, and it was up to us to hold on to them to try to figure out what he wanted to do. He's really sort of trying to not revitalize who he was, but to establish something new in terms of persona. And the persona wasn't the sort of idiosyncratic everyman. It was, now he was a bro dude, and he had gotten caught with his hand in the cookie jar, so to speak. And so he was playing to that audience. He was playing to the stand-up comedians who opened for him, who made dick jokes, who talked about, you know, the science fiction aspect for them of female genitalia. It was all of that sort of smutty 13-year-old boy.
So he's not there to apologize in any way.
He didn't apologize, and he didn't actually make any credible comedic situation to explain what his life had been. For instance, someone that we both love, Richard Pryor, would have become A, the dick, B, the woman, C, Louis looking at the woman, D, the dick looking at Louis. I mean, he would have covered all the bases. Louis just sort of makes a statement about it, and then he goes on to not very interesting situational comedy.
Yeah. So he gets there, and he brings up, he says, if I remember from your piece, do you want to talk about the thing?
Yes.
Describe that moment, because that's the key moment in his act.
Yes.
Do you want to talk about the thing?
And the audience cheered and roared. And he said, I can't tell you. This is where he made a mistake as a comedian. He says, I can't tell you much about the experience, except if you ask someone, may I masturbate in front of you? And they say, okay, don't believe them. If they say that they're fine with it, don't believe them. And I think had he used the brilliance that we were so accustomed to, he would have looked past those words and said, I wanted to believe them. And then the bit would have gone on to say, to describe what that was like for him, why it was transgressive, why he wanted to be caught, why a million other things that happen subconsciously when you do stuff in public. So he never went past those words, not even an apology. He was sort of saying, don't do it, guys. It wasn't an apology. It wasn't really a mea culpa. It was a statement.
Is there a generational divide or a political divide when it comes to how people view this comeback of Louis C.K.'s or other
situations? It was a much younger crowd than I expected. And
very male, right?
I think I would say safely two-thirds of the audience was male and white.
And
I'd say under 40. And I had the panic that you cannot show that no black person in America can show when you walk into the room and you are the only person of color there. I was so relieved at the end of the performance that there was a man of color handing out tickets near the men's room.
There you were.
There we were.
So the audience is white, very male, and also younger. And what you're saying is that the younger audience is somehow more forgiving. In that limited experience.
They might not remember his show by now. I mean, 2015 is a long time ago for a young person.
Right.
They might not remember the show. They remember the controversy.
You write in the article that I am interested in performers who try to work through the difficulties in their own lives by addressing them in art.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the big question. Did Louis C.K. succeed at spinning his troubles into anything like art?
No. What he made me do was miss him.
The old one.
Yeah. Meaning I missed his ability to do situational comedy. This was stand-up, which is very different. Stand-up is a series of jokes, and if you hit on a joke that the audience likes, you can tell a story that goes along with it. His real genius and his gift is for situational comedy, to describe taking a car trip with his kids or to describe, as he does in the show, brilliantly going to an antique shop. He gives so little of that now because I think he's afraid that the audience that he has simply doesn't have the attention span to follow a story from A to Z. As opposed, when he said, I used to play stadiums, that was much more diverse, larger crowd. You're walking around with that mic and you're talking to many different kinds of people. It's sort of like jazz singing. You know, you're doing the notes, you're doing the scales, you're doing the orchestration. When you're working in a club like this and you're aware that there's a lower common denominator in terms of audience response, you start to play down. A lot of great comedians, and I'm thinking of amazing people like Lily Tomlin, Richard Pryor, Sandra Bernhardt, they don't bring the material down to the audience, they bring the audience up.
What were you waiting to hear from him in a way? You'd come to the Yuck Club Club, obviously, to not just to review a show, but to review
a phenomenon,
kind of,
yeah.
Yeah.
I really wanted him to describe himself. I wanted him to be the Louis that I loved, which the person who would have described what those situations were like, not passing any judgment at all on the women, but what his compulsion was. Where did it start? Why was it important for him to masturbate and not be alone? What was it, a performance? Did he want them to like him?
What does somebody like that owe his audience and owe anybody?
I think that like all of us, we owe a certain level of best foot forward to everyone that we're in conversation with in the world. And he wasn't putting any foot forward. He was just kind of dropping the mic, picking it up, dropping the mic and picking it up.
Do you think he's done?
I don't want him to be, actually. There are so few people out there who can use language, and there are so many of us who make mistakes and so many people who suffer. If he could do something, not to redeem himself, but to redeem our belief in him and redeem the lives of those people that he hurt and scarred. He can do it through his art, if he does his art.
Hilton Alls is a staff writer for The New Yorker. Louis C.K. is on tour in Houston and elsewhere.
So let me tell you the story of when I was coming back over the Canadian border to go to Buffalo to go to bed. I'm in the back of the taxi going from the Canadian side back to the U.S. to go to my hotel.
In Buffalo.
And there was a guard, very nice guard, I've never had this experience with law enforcement in my life.
This is at Customs.
Yes. Yeah. And he sees me in the back of the car, and my eyes are watering because of the weather. And he says, why were you here? And I said, I went to see Louis C.K. at the Yucca Comedy Club. And he said, why did you come all the way here? And he said, oh, wait, because of the thing? And I said, yes. And then he said, are you crying? And I said, no. He said, and then he handed me a box of tissues. So it was all worth it.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. One of the marquee issues of the 2020 Democratic campaign has been taxes. Not tax cuts, but higher taxes on the wealthiest Americans. That issue is a cornerstone of the Warren and the Sanders campaign. But these days, you don't have to be a socialist to talk about income inequality as a severe problem.
Let's talk about how to tax the rich. Woohoo!
This is a meeting that took place a couple of months ago in San Francisco.
Thank you for being here today and taking part in this incredibly important conversation. It's time for America's millionaires to start stepping up and tackling inequality head on.
Morris Pearl, who's at the mic here, is not exactly your stereotype of a fired-up leftist. He is really rich, and he's not shy in admitting it.
Being rich is great. I've done it. I recommend you all try it. It's a lot better than the alternative. And I'm not here to talk to you about altruism.
Pearl is the chair of a group that calls itself the Patriotic Millionaires. And he spoke recently with Sheila Kolhatkar, who reports for us on business and the economy.
The Patriotic Millionaires really tap into several things that I'm obsessed with right now. Income inequality, the political debate over how to address income inequality, and the ways that some wealthy people and successful business executives are struggling over how they might play a part in solving this problem. To see a group of these people really sort of publicly advocating for policies that would potentially cost them money, at least in the short term, I thought was really interesting and not something you see very often.
The main issue we're trying to address is the fact that this growing inequality, this having a country with a few rich people, lots of poor people, is not going to work in the long term.
That's Morris Pearl. He's the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires.
Having no middle class doesn't work for the rich people. We make money from our investments when there's millions of people paying their bills on time every month. So that's the overall rubric. We're trying to address that with three policy areas. One is progressive taxation. We're in favor of rich people having higher tax rates than regular people, not the other way around. We're in favor of higher wages for working people. We think that people who work full-time should make enough money to live on.
An argument you typically hear around this issue is that it will hurt small businesses, that small business owners can't afford to pay employees more. They can't afford to pay sick leave.
If small business people are thinking about the minimum wage, they should also think about their customers getting raises. And so if you look at a small business like a restaurant, having the customers with more beer money in their pockets on Friday nights is a lot more important and makes a much bigger difference than how much wages the one guy standing behind the bar pouring the beer is making. So we're in favor of higher minimum wages. And we're also wanting to reduce the influence of big money in politics. We would like to take money out of politics, especially my personal money.
In the past, we've tended to think of wealthy people as wanting one set of policies that benefit them, and then lower-income people wanting a different set of things, higher wages, for example. The Patriotic Millionaires are making the argument that what's good for the people who are lower down the economic ladder is actually better for the people at the top. Morris Pearl grew up as part of a middle-class family in upstate New York, and he actually discovered a passion for computer programming when he was in college. So he became a computer scientist, and he ended up working at a series of Wall Street firms doing complex analysis and helping to design different bond instruments.
I did investment banking work. I fell into sort of the beginning of the securitization field, working on issuing what was called collateralized mortgage obligations, or still is called collateralized mortgage obligations. And that's what I was doing, and I loved doing it. And I was writing big computer programs, and I was helping my friends and myself get rich at the same time. I mean, what's not to love?
A collateralized mortgage obligation is a type of debt instrument that's made up of a bunch of mortgages that are bundled together and turned into an investment. And they played a significant role in causing the financial crisis. Although Morris did become very wealthy, in part by helping to design some of these debt instruments, he never thought of his work in political terms, and he certainly never thought about his wealth as being connected in any way to politics. He really wasn't political at all until his wife got connected with the Howard Dean campaign in 2004.
He was campaigning on sort of against being at war with Iraq. In my mind, it was an opportunity to do something as opposed to just hanging around complaining. And we wanted to go see the convention in Boston that year. And I thought we could watch on TV, but a few phone calls later and a few tens of thousands of dollars later, we were ensconced at the Four Seasons Hotel and playing pool with Ben Affleck and sitting in the upper deck when the skinny guy from Chicago gave his Purple State speech.
The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states. Red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats. But I've got news for them, too. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states.
So you learn pretty quickly about the power of money in terms of generating political access, it sounds like.
Access, yeah. I mean, for a few tens of thousands of dollars, you can become anybody's best friend.
After the financial crisis, Morris worked as part of a group that traveled around the world and helped countries value problematic debt that they were struggling to deal with. This work that he was doing led him to a meeting in Athens where he had a kind of epiphany.
We were in the top floor of this fancy office building on Sophocleus, right in downtown Athens. And I was picking up some chocolate pudding for dessert. I kind of walked to the window so people wouldn't see I was having two chocolate puddings for dessert. And then I thought I was watching a parade. I was thinking to myself, well, it's not a holiday or we wouldn't be working today if it was a holiday. Why is there a parade? And I realized they were having a demonstration. And I kind of turned around finishing dessert and I looked around. And I thought to myself, is it really doing any good for the rest of the people of Greece, other than these guys who are trying to run this bank, which we were trying to help? And a few months later, in early 2014, I just started doing politics and policy work full time. I just thought that was the best way I can contribute to the well-being of, my children and hopefully grandchildren.
Did the Patriotic Millionaires find you initially, or did you find them?
I'd been enjoying getting involved in politics here and there. I'd been meeting a lot of people, some bright, young PR professional people started this group to get a bunch of wealthy people together and put out a letter saying, no, our taxes should not be lowered.
A set of tax cuts, including cuts for the very rich that had been passed by George W. Bush, were set to expire around halfway through President Obama's first term. This was before Morris became chairman of the group.
And he thought we were kind of dorks for attacking him from the left, or at least that's what Ms. Jarrett said he thought. But then they realized that we were actually helping to give them political space to do what they actually wanted to do. Our group is different than a lot of other advocacy groups. There are groups that can mobilize hundreds of people. We don't have hundreds of people in any one city. I don't think I could get 20 people in any one room. But we do have dozens of people who can, like that, get members of Congress on the phone for 5 minutes to explain to them why they should vote for the Raise the Wage Act. So we are in a different position than other advocacy groups, and we try to do what we can to help make progress.
What's the argument you make to someone like you who may not currently see things the way you do?
Well, I try to make the same arguments that I make with you. I explain that the current system is leading towards civil unrest. I saw it on the streets in Athens, Greece, the cradle of democracy. I saw it on election night in 2016. People are not accepting the status quo. And eventually, people are going to say, we're not going to take it anymore. You know, gross inequality did not end well in South Africa for the rich people either.
There are other groups that help wealthy people use their money more responsibly, that promote socially aware investing, for example. But I'm not aware of any groups that are as high profile and politically active as the Patriotic Millionaires. I think a big part of what it's going to take to really make structural changes in the economy that will help alleviate some of the really alarming disparity that we've seen is to create a sort of cultural change around this subject. And having a group of wealthy, successful business people, heirs to family fortunes, going out and talking about this helps create a climate where these ideas are much more acceptable. They help counter the idea that the winners in our economy want one system and everyone else wants something else. I read a piece that you wrote expressing support for Elizabeth Warren's proposed wealth tax. Why do you think that could potentially work?
Now, Warren Buffett pointed out that he pays a lower tax rate than his assistant. Yet Warren Buffett had about $12 million of taxable income the last year that I checked. But really, his wealth increased by billions of dollars that year and almost every year. No amount of taxes on what we call taxable income would have any material effect on the wealth of someone like Mr. Buffett. So that's why a wealth tax would be an important part of this. Over the course of some years, the very wealthiest would be paying in more of their money. And the rest of the people would have to shoulder a smaller piece of the burden of whatever amount of revenue the government needs to run the country.
If you potentially would have to pay such a tax, would you still support it?
Yes. You know, I don't particularly want to pay more taxes personally, but I want the system to be fair, and I want my children, and now I have a grandchild, to grow up with the kind of opportunities that I had. That's what I really want. I mean, what's the purpose of making money if not to make the lives of your children better?
Morris Pearl, a former managing director of BlackRock and the chairman of the Patriotic Millionaires. He spoke with Sheila Kolhatkar, a staff writer at The New Yorker. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Karen Frohman, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino. With help from Danny Bonner, Morgan Flannery, Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
A lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.